and broader approach to life. A clergyman or a teacher or an instructor in religious matters cannot hope to be perfectly informed on all the problems that a congregation or a student body may bring to him. He cannot have been through every type of experience. He might like to hope that he may have a grand key which he can apply to all types of experience, but very few have succeeded in this, actually, because there has to be a certain factual relationship between the person and a circumstance before he can be an authority on it. But the people who come expect help and need it. So the only recourse under such conditions is to find out from those who have specialized in other fields the best available information that can be passed on to this particular person in trouble. It's safe to say that in the course of a ministry of 25 or 50 years, the individual, the teacher, will be required to bring some type of consolation or insight to persons of hundreds of different characteristics, different characters, different relationships with life, different races, different nationalities, different religious denominations, different arts and sciences. All these people, regardless of what they're in, get into trouble. They get into situations which they cannot handle, and they come for help, and they expect to have it. And, of course, in actuality, probably the only thing on earth that can possibly bring answers to all these problems is divinity itself. But to the average practitioner in any field of public service, there is a responsibility to bring the best available information, to give to the person in trouble that which is the best known solution to his problem. And to do this, we have to continually work with various fields of knowledge. These fields of knowledge do not necessarily become obsessional. We do not have to allow ourselves to fall into a slough of despond over the conflicts of knowledge. But we do need, if possible, a working basis to help other people. And we cannot assume that these other people will all be benefited by that which is most appealing to ourselves. We have to be prepared to meet these different situations that arise in life. Therefore, it's a good thing sometimes to keep a casebook. If you are in public life and are working as a teacher or counselor or in healing or any of these fields, it is very advisable to keep a good, solid record of what has been done to each individual, how they have been worked with, what their problem was originally, and the best information, the best light we could cast upon this subject. Another might do much better, but that we had done the best that we could. Then we have to watch and see what happens. And if we find out in after time that our advice has not been good, that the individual either could not or did not apply it, then we have to give further thought to the situation. This is quite common now with certain metaphysical organizations. Many of these people get into difficulties, go to the organization and try to get help, and the organization cannot give it to them. The reason why this happens is that the organization has not kept records of the consequences of its own instructions. It is said that this all was an inspired situation, that some divine power was the back of the whole thing, and if anyone got into trouble as a result of it, it would have to be considered their own fault. This is an evasion of fact. The individuals, and I know some who have been in and out of a dozen different movements and organizations, and have gradually come to the simple fact that the person has to determine in his own life and nature what is honorable and what is right. He has to escape from the glamour of promises that can never be fulfilled. In life everywhere, wherever a promise is made in which there is no contribution on the part of the individual to fulfill the requirements of that promise, there will be trouble. Even then, if the promise was wrong, there will still be trouble. But everywhere we go, we have to gradually change opinions into facts. Heraclitus said, opinionism is a falling sickness of the reason. And this is essentially true. We cannot be expected to solve problems by opinions. Sometimes a person will come to us and say, what is your opinion on this matter? Actually, it's not very much value, anybody's opinion. The answer is, what are the facts? And in order to get the facts, the individual has to wade through the emotional pressure of promises and of various inducements, and perhaps most of all, the strange dedication to trying to become a god in a short time. All these things have to be removed from the picture. What are the facts? And when it comes to the facts, the pencil and paper are extremely useful because you have to live with it later. You can't say a month later, I didn't say that, which is a very quick way out of a very difficult situation. Or, I shouldn't have done that to this particular person. Gradually, by controlling the results of our conduct because of the consequences that they obviously cause, we get to the point where our instruction or information becomes more practically useful and practical. We also have the problem, which are now being emphasized, of physical ailments and the records necessary to understand them. Nearly every doctor who is a reputable physician keeps a constant record on the condition of his patient. He keeps a constant testing of their health situation and advocates periodic examinations. Now, these may be more expensive and unnecessary, but the principle involved is that there must be a recording. The physician must know what is happening to the person. And yet that same individual at home, with no particular physical problem that is noticeable, keeps no record of the happenings which affect his emotional life or his relation with other people or his employment, his recreation, his activities, his relaxations. All of these things are just, well, they just happen. He comes home tired out, sits in front of the television with a television dinner, and watches a baseball game. This has become a pattern with millions of people. It is estimated at the present time that sports in America have the largest listening or viewing audience that there is, and that almost any evening, out of the 250 million people in the United States, 75 million will be looking at sports. Well, that's all right. Sports are not going to hurt the individual particularly, but they're not going to do him very much good. Sports are all right, but not as a constant, continuous, inevitable way of escaping responsibility. It's pretty difficult to do any intelligent thinking while watching a football game. But the individual can divide his time, but he should not consider his life to be caused to be fulfilled by wasting time. He comes home tired. He feels that he has bought the right to do as he pleases in the evening, so he does that which, for instance, is his outlet. But it's because he has nothing else. Somewhere in the life of this individual, there should be interests that help to develop and unfold the character and temperament of each person that comes into the world. He should have a constant record of the things that are important that he is accomplishing. It may be that he should take up a language. Perhaps he would find it much more valuable to himself to become an artist or be a musician. At least those things are discipline. We may say, of course, that an artist, so what? There are lots of artists. That's true. But every artist has a dedication. He has a dedication of some kind to the performance of a skillful action. He learns the palette. And if he wants to, he will see in the palette the history of the universe. because the color combinations that he makes are part of a spectrum that originates in the divine life itself. He also learns the mixtures of colors as seen in nature. He discovers one tremendously important thing, namely, that the colors he sees with his eyes are not, in many cases, the true colors at all. Here he is seeing something, as we might say, with a well-tempered vision, instead of the thing as it actually is. Also, the artist has a tremendous potential. He is the only person who can change a landscape anytime he wants to. If he doesn't like three trees in a picture, he just eliminates a tree. And he does it without chopping a tree down or hurting anything. All he is doing is fulfilling his own sense of proportion, propriety, harmony, and rhythm. Great artists like Durer, Michelangelo, Leonardo were great mathematicians. They were also great anatomists and physiologists. They produced inventions in many fields of life. They had a profound study of the human body. And the diagrams and figures of Leonardo da Vinci on the development of the fetus are among the great masterpieces of art and science. So here's an artist who is all things. And in every art, science, trade, craft that the individual takes up, there is an opportunity to share in an infinite wisdom. There is an opportunity to make the thing you are doing a teacher not only of your mind, but of your heart and of your soul. All these constructive outlets make people happier and help to make life more important. Therefore, if some time is taken from the wasting of time, then we can also realize that the person will be preparing for a retirement in which the mind will be filled with constructive and hopeful expectations of further opportunities to learn. These are the things that make life important. Muhammad always divided his day by the 24-hour rule. 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours of service. The individual has the opportunity to take recreation and make it the basis of the most happy and wonderful experience of growth that is imaginable. Recreation is a kind of dance of life, as Havelock Ellis called it. It is an opportunity for the individual to have the joy and glory of moving along toward the source of all good, and doing it in a happy way. But for some reason or other, we have become of the mind that if it's good for us, it's unpleasant. This is not according to good sense or according to good religion, but it has involved itself in practically every aspect of human growth. To be a growing person, you must be a frustrated one. This is as far from the truth as anything you can imagine. To be a truly growing person, you must be a completely free person, free from the fallacies of your own attitudes. This does not mean that you go up on the top of a mountain. It doesn't mean that you join some kind of a club of the discontented. It doesn't mean that you are now entitled to use all the cocaine you want. Freedom is the actual wonderful privilege of being right. And because we are right, not having to worry about trying to get over the mistakes to which we have been in service for so many years. All these things can also add up to perhaps another type of literature, and that is to write the book of the thing as it ought to be. You might sometime find it interesting to take yourself as the hero of the world. Now, this sounds like audacity right now. The individual will say, it's never going to happen to me. At least that's what he says, but a lot of them believe it is. Anyway, the idea, however, is that you're the hero of a story, and that this story is your own life, and that therefore you're going to write a wonderful play, a wonderful drama, a great book on the fictionalizing of your own life. You're going to do all kinds of interesting things that you may never factually do, but you're also going to dramatize your own reactions to life. If you love nature, that's going to be in there. If you have a great love for children, that's going to be a leading factor. If you've had an unhappy and frustrated life, you're going to be able to show other people how they can transform these limitations, as you believe that you have, or certainly are going to try. Little by little, you can move yourself into the person you know you ought to be. You're the person who is kindly to others, temperate in all their attitudes, lives without over-domination of ego, is not much interested in fame or fortune, but is interested in living an unfolding of personal existence toward reality. In other words, to fulfill the reason why we are here. Now, some people will be able to approach this very carefully and very cautiously, very thoughtfully. To others, it'll be simply a general motion. But if it's nothing more than a natural resolution to correct faults one by one, it is a tremendous motion in the right direction. Wherever in writing down your list of peculiarities, you find that you are easily irritated, or that you have great trouble answering the telephone, or that you don't like to be the victim of uninvited guests, that all these things you can work through. You can gradually organize the situation so that you can control every phase of it. And whatever comes along, becomes no interference in anything whatsoever. There are no interruptions, as Zen points out. What we call an interruption is simply a lump in Zen. It is a small bump somewhere, but it means nothing. And as the Zen master goes along a little further, the bump becomes a koan. In a little while, the interruption becomes a key to the improvement of the discipline itself. So we don't anymore have these pressures. One of the rewards for trying to get rid of them, certainly, one of the rewards is better personal life. A second reward is greater usefulness to other people and the improvement of our characteristics and our temperaments. Another reward is our relationship to the younger generation that is coming up, a generation which is in deadly need, in terrific need of good example. The generation that is wild, but is more or less following frustrated or wild parents, if they are belonging to peer groups which are not commendable and very seldom inclined to accept the family itself as the peer group. It goes outside to those who break the rules and become the heroes. Now, this type of thing becomes a responsibility for all thoughtful persons. The older generation must begin to give a better example to these young people. It must begin to live as it would have those young people live. It would have to gain their confidence. It would have to prove that the parent is thoughtful, reasonable, factual in his recommendations. And if he claims to have ideals, that he is living them or trying to as well as he can. To try to teach a child morality with no intentions of applying the rules to your own nature is one of the reasons why we are in the present condition. Everyone busy doing what they want to do and neglecting what they ought to do. Wherever children appear, they are a responsibility that must be faced. And every effort to avoid that responsibility should be written down in the little black book, because it is something that you're either going to have to correct, or there's going to be a sequel in that book that you're not going to be very happy about. But if the individual observes and can write down the number of times a child's interruption has been rejected, don't bother me now, I'm busy, on how many times the interruption has been accepted, and the parent and child have settled down to discuss something of great importance to the child. Well, you can write out these things. You will find the consequences just pile right up. And you can say beyond all doubt that you have actual, factual proof that the enlightened and dedicated life is right and is the thing that pays off and will give the person the greatest opportunity to be of service to other people. Nowadays, with the situation as it is, there's a great deal of exploitation in the field of religion. There are a great many organizations that promise what they cannot fulfill or are recognizing the possibility of financial advantage from the confusion and bewilderment of people. In other words, there are thousands, millions of people in the world today who honestly believe, or think they honestly believe, that they can buy salvation. They believe that if they can build a church or put in a stained glass window, they belong to the elect. They believe definitely that they can contribute without contributing anything of themselves. The individual may, out of charity and understanding, contribute to causes. There's no reason why he shouldn't. But there is no way by which a contribution can be assured to be the basis of an immediate or reasonably immediate salvation. The individual is saved not by that type of thing, for he's giving the least part of himself. He's giving something he couldn't take with him anyway. He's sometimes giving something he got dishonestly in the first place. But whether he got it honestly or dishonestly, the gift without the giver is bare, says Longfellow. It is only when the individual's gift is backed by dedication to principles. And today, a great many organizations are not much worried about those dedications. They want the gifts. Well, some of them are having a hard time, let's face it. But the individual who is expected to help them must have the ability to determine within himself what is right, what is just, and what is worthy of assistance. He must recognize that nothing that is worthy is going to make the path to personal growth a flowery bed of ease. It is going to be troublesome always. It's going to be work. The individual must fight continually against the conspiracy of selfishness within himself. But he can and should realize that he must grow. He cannot be converted into salvation. He cannot be given some kind of a formula and be told he's a member of something and have anything happen unless he makes it happen. There is no shortcut to truth. It is a long, hard, difficult road. But it is something that gradually becomes so magnificent in its own nature that regardless of what it costs, the individual would not compromise it even for a moment. But there is that time of getting to that point, the time to compass the entire worldly material that has been burned into us by sorrow and trouble and responsibility. So we think that gradually, taking all these factors together, that the average individual's life is worth a careful documentation. Now, sometimes this happens after they're dead. It's more biographies are written after death than you would shake a stick at. But, you know, there's a fallacy about these biographies. They are really not written to tell about the person. They are written to amuse an audience. In other words, most biographies that we read are more or less disillusionments of one kind or another. The individual is downgraded. Now, some will say, perhaps he isn't downgraded. Perhaps the person who we have regarded as a hero was really much of a scallywag. Well, even that doesn't justify the situation, because we all know that people cannot be everything at once. So some people are good and some people are bad. But those exploitation books that are written simply for sale dramatize situations that may not even be true. But if the time comes later when honesty prevails, we can imagine a biography written after death by somebody who really tried to tell the facts of a case. Perhaps our own little book, that diary that we have kept down through the years, could inspire someone to a great book. A book that would be honest, would tell the troubles and the struggle and the victories. the defeats, the individual bowed down to earth and rising victoriously again. It would be a story of an individual groping after realities and dedicated to the finding of them. He may pass out of this life without finding many of them, but he'll find a few. But if his dedication is once established, and the only thing he really wants in this world is to know how to help, how to be useful to the divine plan of things, when he gets into the other life, he probably will have further opportunities to grow, and he will be rewarded, not necessarily for his achievements, but for his dedications. If he has tried in small ways, he will be better off than those who didn't try in big ways. It is all a matter of growing. And the idea that Pythagoras had in connection with this keeping of records was to make the individual his own teacher. How by little thoughtfulness and by observing the consequences of what we do, we will gradually learn to live better. We will gradually find out that when we hurt another, we ultimately hurt ourselves. And as some of the Oriental philosophers have said, when we hurt another, we have hurt ourselves in the other. Because actually, there's only one life anyway. And when we do ill to one, we do ill to the source of all. So we try our best to do things constructively, and we try to organize our daily life. We can start in by taking a single day and trying to organize it, and then seeing what happens. We will find by the second or third day the organization crumbles under the pressure of unusual or unexpected events. But with a little effort, we can finally discover that many of these events that have interrupted a pattern can themselves be eliminated. And the person can continue the projects or the purposes for which he is dedicated. Another problem that happens, that I think is very much in Western religions especially, is that the individual who is dedicated nearly always takes on a deadly seriousness. We haven't discovered, apparently, the dance of life. We haven't discovered perhaps what some of the older people who were not so smart in some things really discovered, namely that after all, growth is the most joyous process that there is. To grow in wisdom is a magnificent adventure. Growth is not brought about by frustration. It is not the individual turning away from the world. It is the individual who examines the world and finds its own natural beauties that gradually grows. There are many things in the world that we have to consider as serious, but there are not so many that we have to react to with too much seriousness. It becomes wrong, because growth, the child growing, isn't fighting growth. The people in passing through various stages of life find it's impossible to fight them. All they can do is put them in order and use each period of life as an opportunity for the expression of a great beauty. And it doesn't make any difference whether it is the newborn babe or the centenarian. Beauty is always there. Tremendous values are always there. And the individual who learns to appreciate them does not become an outcast, does not become a cynic. He remains what he always has to be if he wants to grow, and that is ever aware that the mistakes and sorrows and problems of life are all part of the growing pains of human beings. They're there for the individual to transform and transmute by his own consciousness. And there was a belief in antiquity, at least, that no one was ever presented with a problem so great that he couldn't do something about it. That it is not necessary to assume that our problems are so vast that we cannot solve them. Nor is it our responsibility to take on unsolvable problems and try to solve them. The problem is to grow graciously, to try to find the thing that would make the individual today attractive to the younger generation growing up. That the parental attitudes are enlightened, that they are gentle, kindly, thoughtful, unselfish, and yet have within them a strength of discipline. Discipline is the most important thing in the world for the average person, and there is nothing they resent more. Discipline is given in the army, and while it is not a very good cause, we'll accept that, very many of those who have gone through army discipline have become much better people as a result. They have come out of that discipline with the ability to obey commands, ability to do things that are needed to be done, and to do them without efforts to avoid or evade. But anyway, discipline is the thing that we all have to have. And a discipline of a parent for a child must be enlightened. The discipline that we apply to ourselves must be enlightened. We cannot simply blindly swing out at something with an outburst of temper or something of this nature. Discipline has to be gradually gained in the way a musician gains the skill to play an instrument. If he did not practice for years, he could not play it. If the individual doesn't practice self-discipline for years, he will not achieve it. The only way in which some seem to be able to shorten this apprenticeship to discipline is through a mystical religious illumination. Some people who have been very worldly, for instance, St. Francis de Assis is one of the examples. A person who has been very worldly and has gradually exhausted the possibilities of excess, who has gradually wasted their ownings or their lives or their health, destroyed the relationships with other people, and gone on to a very difficult situation. These people occasionally, on rare occasions, but it does happen, suddenly have an inner awakening. They suddenly see, know, and believe the mistakes that they have made. They also seemingly are the ones who were able to remember a combination of circumstances, remember the details of their own degradation, and at the same time remember the details of the universal plan of salvation. In any event, these people suddenly have an internal enlightenment. This internal enlightenment is something, as several of them have said in attempting to write the explanation, that there is no way of telling what this is. Words completely useless. Those who have it cannot name it, and those who name it haven't got it. Whatever it is a mysterious unfolding of light within their own lives, an enlightenment that forever corrects most of the mistakes which they have made. This enlightenment, which in a sense is a miraculous cleansing of the inside of the cup, where suddenly the individual realizes his true place in the order of things. In the case of St. Francis, we know the story of a tremendous dedication, a story of reaching out towards all things that live. St. Francis preaching to the birds, St. Francis representing pain and sorrow as his brothers and sisters. Everything strangely transformed into a mystic ritual of regeneration. A certain story of that, a similar story, is told in St. John of the Cross and many others. But it is a tremendous psychic enlightenment. It is as though a mysterious spiritual bomb had exploded within them and destroyed worldliness. This type of thing doesn't happen to everyone, but it does also come in smaller assignments and arrangements. So against certain retributional pressures of life, there is this tremendous dynamic change of life. It is real because the individual no longer is capable of doing the wrong things that he did before. He can no longer go back. It isn't a discipline that he imposes upon himself. It isn't something he says, I shouldn't do it. It is something that from the soul of himself he says, I can't do it. And once this becomes a solid thing, that the person can no longer break the rules, because suddenly the rules become the most beautiful things in creation. When this happens, of course, the individual has, in a sense, transcended the long process of gradual self-discipline. And it is therefore perhaps why sometimes the greater sinner becomes the greatest saint. It is something, a revulsion against evil. But we don't always have that. We don't even need it necessarily unless it is next for us. What we really need and what we have to cultivate at all times is this growing realization of the beauty of doing it right, the beauty of no longer permitting the doubts and fears of the personality to interfere with the life of a serene dedication. If we really believe in the divinity that shapes our ends, if we really believe that there is a power beyond our own, a power which is guiding us with love and wisdom forever, we can begin to accept that, and we can write in the little book, "Today I kept it. Today I had a decision to make, and I made it right. Then the next day I tried again, but didn't do so well." But over a period of time, these records will tell us what we are accomplishing. They will also help us to plan a purpose for our own lives that extends perhaps far beyond the boundaries of the present body. It helps to make us citizens of the universe, and most of all, good citizens. It helps us to become part of that great life which is dedicated to the service of life, to the service of realities, to the service of the divine essence, the divine substance that has been built into us and which we are able to witness. In other words, it is the divine power coming through so that we all become manifestations of the infinite goodness and the infinite love that protects all things. If we begin to feel that way and think that way, little problems will fall away, and gradually larger problems will be modified. And if we keep records of what happens when we do it right, we will gradually realize that it is not very profitable to do it wrong. Well, that's all for today, folks.